What is real? How do you define real?
You can't jump into cash. Cash is trash. What do? You get out.
Eric Kaysen is a crypto anarchist, iconoclast, Marikarismos, who writes about the ramifications of Bitcoin, and he is also the director of client service at OnChain Capital. He's written several notable essays on crypto sovereignty, the dynamite piece, Bitcoin, and the state of emergency, which was recently published in the Bitcoin Times edition number 3. Welcome to the Bitcoin Matrix podcast, Eric. How are you?
I'm doing great. Thank you very much for having me.
Yeah, man. Psyched to talk to you. Congratulations on the new role at OnChained. That sounds awesome. I'm actually going to try to get hooked up with them shortly and get into the multi-sig over there. But I really kind of wanted to jump back to your life before Bitcoin. And, you know, I think before Bitcoin, we went to college, you studied international relations and you wanted to be a diplomat. And you were kind of maybe even thought of yourself as kind of far left.
Yeah. You know, I went to college in San Francisco. You know, it's kind of a hotbed for that activity and those ideas. And after studying international relations, I really wanted to be a diplomat. I really thought the state was this, you know, it really meant well, and we just had to get the right people in the right place. And then my experiences of 2008 and the fallout from that, struggling to find work, and just kind of the difficulty of moving through that eventually led me kind of the Occupy Wall Street movement, where that's kind of when I was at the deepest. I maybe even self-identified at the time as being, you know, far left socialist, communist. And my experience with Occupy really led me to question that and seeing how difficult organization was, how disingenuous some of the ideology was. And the final point was I couldn't make sense of the economic part. So in the fallout of that, I'd met some anarchists who really turned me on to anarchist philosophy. And in that turn, I really decided that while I understood a lot of the ideas coming from the far left, they ultimately just didn't work, which kind of caused for me to get more and more interested in anarchist philosophy. And eventually I came across somebody who was an anarchist. I was into Bitcoin, who was like, you need to look into this. Like, this is going to be the future. Couldn't tell you who that was or when it was. But I started to dig and I was hooked pretty quick.
Sure. You kind of really described your experience with the Occupy movement there really well, but maybe more like a 10,000 foot, like what was it like maybe in the trenches and the conversations that were happening there and the vibe and the energy and were you in New York or in the movement in San Francisco or Oakland or somewhere else?
So I was involved in the movement in Oakland. At first, you know, it was a really powerful, strong, dynamic movement. Seeing that we were having influence and media's attention felt powerful, giving people a place where they could publicly speak out about their anger and frustration with the system and the way that, you know, we had been sold up the, you know, up the creek by the powers that be. That all felt really good. But as I dug in with people, I really started to realize that there was a lot of hopium here, but there wasn't much substance. There wasn't much of an idea of, okay, if we do seize power or challenge these things, what happens with that? But I was still enthusiastic. It was fun to be on the front lines and, you know, fight cops and that kind of stuff. So I went out to Philadelphia. They had a national Occupy gathering there. It didn't turn out to be what I wanted it to be. Got my ass pretty thoroughly kicked by a number of police officers. Wow. And at that point, I was like, you know, that I don't think this is really working right here. And that's when I was starting to learn more about anarchism, came back west, moved in with my parents for a while. And I like worked at a moving company and did some other remedial work. I was reading about anarchism, getting steeped in that philosophy. And at the same time, I had a friend who, like I said, I couldn't tell you who it was or when it was. They had mentioned Bitcoin and said I should look into it. Started reading about it. And I got hooked pretty quick. And that really sent me kind of on my path towards discovering Bitcoin in my own idea. And then I joined Coinbase in mid to late 2013, you know, and that was just my real first tour of duty, learning everything, getting experience, meeting people. And as difficult that it was at times, you know, really great people, really, really special experience. And I remember, you know, I think a lot of people who were there would probably identify the same of that, you know, Coinbase in those years was a pretty special and unique experience with some really powerful and talented people.
Sure. What was the vibe like in 2013? Was in being a startup, and you know, what was the vibe like at Coinbase then?
Oh, you know, like kind of traditional startup in terms of there was lots of fires to put out. People were jumping on whatever they could. There was lots of wearing different hats. I was hired on with a group of, I think, four other guys who most of them all stayed at the company for quite a while. I think one guy's even still there, actually. But yeah, we all pitched in. It was really great. People were really enthusiastic about Bitcoin. Everybody who was there got it, and they wanted to participate in helping build a company that was going to be this bridge between fiat and Bitcoin. It wasn't even until, I guess like 2015 that the conversation started to turn towards other cryptocurrencies and that kind of stuff.
When they listed Litecoin?
I think that was right towards my end, you know, and that's kind of obvious. Charlie was in-house and, right. People were familiar with it from that. Vitalik had came in and talked with people there as well. And the thing that really kind of started to, in my experience when I was there, the Bitcoin Cash hard fork came up, and that kind of put us in a dilemma where, what do we do? Because we have all of this Bitcoin of clients. And so Coinbase made the decision to people their Bitcoin Cash, which that was also kind of towards when my end of being there. But it was pretty clear that, people were curious about the listings of these new assets, and it seems like they made the decision to move forward with that.
Right, right. Yeah, I have really mixed feelings about Coinbase. I can understand and appreciate that, they want to provide a service and sell what people may or may not want. But I really come from the view now that by placing other coins alongside Bitcoin, it really gets people to think that they're similar and to compare and contrast and really think about price point. And I sort of have resentment along that line. So I have mixed feelings. And I really think they're probably running naked right now with only like 130 million on the balance sheet in Bitcoin.
I couldn't really comment on current internal operations at all, but I have mixed feelings about them too. Doing support there was difficult, and we had a really great team, but we're always kind of running behind, because a lot of the team was remote. It was harder to get as much say as we needed kind of in product development and stuff. So I have a lot of mixed feelings about it too, because I felt like support in a lot of ways was almost treated like it was its own company. And I think that was a disservice to clients because, one of the reasons I continue to do support operations is because I truly believe that clients should have a say in how the platform is being conducted and operated. And specifically if they're running into issues or if there are several of the same complaints bubbling up, I think that they should have a voice in making those corrections be changed. And there's just other disagreements, and ultimately you burn out at a job like that. So I was there for 4 years by the time I left. And I was just ready to do something else. So I took time out with my family, did that. And I was just doing my own thing. And the director of sales at Unchained reached out and he was like, "Hey, check out our product. We have a role that sounds like it would fit you really well. Let me know." And I was pretty uninterested in working again. But when I looked at their product, I was like, whoa, like this multi-sig thing's really cool. The way that you guys aren't rehypothecating loans is a great way to be able to let people borrow against their Bitcoin and still have it be secured. So I was like, yeah, this seems like it's the right fit for me. Yeah, they're an awesome team of hardcore Bitcoiners that, in my opinion, this is the next iteration of the ecosystem, because with everything that's going on, like I feel pretty strongly that there's going to be some cataclysmic event where there's going to be a lot of fallout, and it's going to turn out that somebody relents something to somebody else, and we'll see something collapse. And I just think it's a course in free markets, like that's how it works out, and people will learn a lesson. I hope I'm mistaken insofar that, I don't want people to lose money like that, but I just have a hard time seeing how something like that doesn't occur.
Yeah, I think that's inevitable and unfortunate, but sort of part of the process for learning both about the people in the industry and how they use these products and services and the risks they're taking on, whether they realize it or not. You really think about Bitcoin very deeply, And I think that we need to kind of define certain things before we kind of really get into some of your writing. So like, sure. what is an iconoclast, or what does it mean when someone calls themselves an iconoclast?
Somebody that really runs against the grain, you know, that they have different opinions and that they don't march the same beat of a drum as everybody else. And yeah, you know, like I've always sort of positioned myself that way. And that's what originally brought me to Bitcoin. You know, and again, the other great thing about Coinbase was just being exposed to other Bitcoiners. You know, like I didn't meet any Bitcoiners in meat space until I had been there. And so getting to share those ideas and riff off each other really helped them develop in a deeper and more powerful way. And I think alternative thought patterns in this space are really important. You know, people know about number go up, Austrian economics, other things. To me, what's really important is asking these more quintessential questions about like what fundamentally is Bitcoin's being? Like, what is its essence? Like, is it a language? Is it a money? Is it an asset? Is it a storage of value? Like, what do these words actually mean, and how do we differentiate them? And unfortunately, I think as robust as a lot of the education that the system's had, and I think in this more recent cycle, we've seen more of it, but I still think there's a huge wealth of development. And to be honest with you, I would really love to see Marxists take Bitcoin seriously and try to apply their own thought to it, because I actually think Marxism as a theory meets with Bitcoin in a pretty powerful way, if those on the left can kind of step past their own ideological perspective towards Bitcoin.
Sure. There's definitely a lot to unpack there. My prior thought about Unchained was that, you know, I think what they're doing fits your ideals. Now I'd like to ask you, what is a Macarismos?
Macarismos. That's on my Twitter profile, and I came across that word recently, and I really loved it. I was reading through Hobbes's Leviathan once again, and he uses this word to talk about, first he stipulates what's really important is that this is an ancient Greek word that doesn't actually have a translation towards English, but what it essentially means is for an individual who's called blessed. This word appears, I think, like 5 or 6 times in the Bible. And it's the idea of that somebody in their life, through the action that they choose to take, unifies themselves with the God and gets their blessings through the existence that he has. And he's talking about this towards the idea of a felicity that can only occur in this life, and that you can only achieve this idea of spectacular, ecstatical kind of happiness in unison with your God through the opportunities that are only available in this life to you, you know, and that's dependent upon your own personal pathway and development that's happened to you in the world.
You mentioned before that a lot of people come to Bitcoin for things like Austrian economics and monetary policy and inflation, but your work really focuses more on, like, for me, what I pull out of is law and sovereignty and what it really means to be crypto. And so, like, another base level question is, so what is theological and continental philosophy?
Well, theological philosophy explicitly deals with the idea of God and kind of what and how God is operating in the world, what that word itself even means, and specifically how his operations are going to play out in this world. If we do believe in him, and if we do, you know, believe that this world has some idea towards that. And just to be clear, like, I think the word God is, it's an extremely loaded word. Some people find it offensive, and it's difficult for people to even get past that. And for me, when I'm utilizing that word, I'm trying to point towards something that's greater than all of us, that unifies all of us. You know, the rest of that's up to be debated. And then continental philosophy specifically comes out of the school of mostly German Jewish philosophers from the 1930s that, you know, kind of starting with Heidegger and developing through that same concourse. It's a whole school of philosophy that looks at stuff in a really different and alternative way, looks at language structures and ideological structures. And for me personally, kind of the leading figure that I follow in the continental school of philosophy is Giorgio Ambigen. And through him, a German philosopher from the 1930s, who was actually a prominent Nazi, named Carl Schmitt. And a lot of people have really stepped away from Carl Schmitt because of his association with the Third Reich, which is understandable. While I don't think he performed any crimes directly, he did some pretty heinous stuff, like defending Hitler after the Night of the Long Knives and that kind of stuff. But with that being said, I was exposed to him through Giorgio Ambigen, and he had developed a theory of sovereignty on his own that really addressed a lot of the ideas that Hobbes had originally brought up. And essentially his theory of sovereignty is the sovereign is he who decides on the exception, and that you can never actually tell who's sovereign except for the one that can create the exceptions to the rule.
And so how do you think law, like what is the place of law in our society today? And kind of maybe at the heart of that, like how are oaths at the base of our entire social contract?
That's an excellent question. Well, I think the law is predicated upon this original idea of that there's this social contract that we somehow were born into this life where we made this agreement with the state where we gave up our sovereignty to them in order for them to, you know, protect us under their umbrella of law. However, what the truth is actually that this thing we called law, it's no longer tied to any kind of magnanimity or ethics or ideals that marry it directly to the ethical predications of what it originally was. Instead, it's just a raw political concept that's exercised by the state. You know, so for example, if I'm caught with drugs that they have deemed illegal for whatever reason they've deemed that illegal, you know, I can face the same punishment as a rapist or somebody else. And to me, like this is sort of some of the obfuscations that get created around law that muddy the waters. Whereas when we talk about the idea of an oath, that's something more that we make to something ourselves and it makes it back to us as a kind of mutualism. And that's one of the things that the law is kind of fundamentally lacking today is this actual mutualism of an oath being taken between us and for each other. And furthermore, if one is to break that oath to one another, the forsakement that it gives to each other. And so while this idea doesn't necessarily seem as clear kind of with our own contemporary ideals of what law is, it makes a lot more sense in this idea of almost crypto law. You know, like the oath that Bitcoin makes to me when I deposit my Bitcoin into an address is that it will protect it no matter what, with the exception of the private key. If I can expose the private key, it'll give me the money. You know, and so my oath is to keep that private key sacred and protected in such a way that nobody else could get it. And furthermore, because of the way that Bitcoin doesn't understand who I am or what I am, all it cares about is that private key. And so this almost creates a new and different sort of law that operates on top of cryptography, which exposes and opens an entirely new and different world for us to create a new social contract with one another that utilizes cryptography as its base to create that social contract.
Yeah. Before we delve into all about the new stuff that Bitcoin creates, let's kind of backtrack a bit. And what is statecraft? And when did this idea kind of evolve? And what did that change?
Yeah, statecraft's the idea of kind of how the state chooses to function and govern. And, you know, Thomas Hobbes, he was really kind of the first philosopher of politics and one of presenting an idea of how the state and sovereignty functions. And ultimately, in my opinion, what happened was, you could say starting with World War I, concluding with World War II, statecraft evolved in an entirely different way that was predicated on top of this emergency. Because we were now having these great wars, which were hyper-accelerated through the mechanization of weapons, you know, specifically stuff like machine guns, we were now at these levels of horrific amounts of killing that was far beyond anything ever experienced before. And as the war engaged deeper and became more extreme, the state started exercising greater and greater emergency powers, you know, such as being able to create the Federal Tax Act that, you know, created income tax and having control of the economy vis-a-vis fiat money. And then including the interwar period, FDR's ending of the gold standard. And then finally, all the way up into World War II, I would say that, this new form of statecraft reached its apex at, well, one, developing the computer for cryptography itself and the ability to break the Enigma code, which is a very fascinating concept in and of itself. And the other was nuclear energy, the ability to create atomic weaponry. And I think these two things are extremely important because, one, they could have only ever been developed with the state at this extreme place where warfare was the first and fundamental and foremost importance of things. But furthermore, it created this entire conceptualization where the state itself led all of humanity forward. And that was a unique instance that we hadn't seen before, specifically utilizing technology. So yeah, that's kind of in a nutshell of how I think statecraft has changed fundamentally kind of since antiquity to now.
Yeah, I really want to explore these ideas around state and sovereignty and really what you call the perpetual emergency, or at least I got that from your writing. And so like, how does the state use corruption to favor themselves and disfavor others? And sort of the crutch of that question is like, is the law really the law?
Precisely. And I think that that's an extremely important question to ask ourselves because, and I find this is frequently sort of the disagreement that I'll have with my friends that are on the left side of the spectrum is that I go, look, like I really understand and empathize with your idea that the government can be this really great and wonderful force. Is that this government? And I think that that's important because it highlights the corruption aspect of that men gather power for themselves. And that's fundamentally the first and the most important thing. There's a great quote from, I can't name his name offhand, but it was a famous American politician from the 18th century. He said something to the effect that men seek to be good masters, but they seek to be masters first. And that's really important because when we're talking about a concept of law, those who control and conduct the law are going to ensure that it favors them first and foremost. And the way that we see policing in the United States is an excellent example of this. I very much believe most cops are good guys out there with good intentions. But the problem is when that comes in direct conflict of do I protect myself and my friends or this other individual, it's going to be their side of the line every time. And so we start to see these cracks develop in this idea of law that we have that perhaps it's not actually to serve us, but it's to serve those in power first and foremost. And because the conflict that arises between us and those in power, it fundamentally means the law starts to break down when those structures get challenged.
Yeah, I agree with everything you said there. And so like when we look at like the state and sovereignty, and we now think about sort of like that exception, but now like that perpetual exception or the perpetual emergency. And I think, you know, I got this from your writing that we really started to see this in World War II with the way the Nazis treated the Jews and communists. And then, you know, I would add the way, you know, the US treated the Japanese, you know, with internment camps. And sort of we accepted these people and stripped them of their rights. And I'm talking about all over the world, not just the US and the Japanese, but and I wonder what's going to happen in the 21st century with global immigration and, you know, but not getting that into that too much today's issue with global immigration. But like more groundwork is like, what is a commonwealth or res publica in Latin?
Great. Yeah. So res publica is the Latin word for the public thing, but it was also the reference to the state itself. And that's what, the translation of res publica then became the commonwealth. And Thomas Hobbes again was one to translate that first. And I think this idea of, you know, the fact that the root word wealth is in there is one of the fundamental principles of what a commonwealth is it's supposed to be about the commonality of how we can govern our laws together in order to ensure the wealth of our society together. And I actually think it's pretty interesting that in modernity that we actually pretty much have an inversion of that, of it's no longer a common wealth, but it's a commonality of poverty, you know, because of the way that the state chooses to extract wealth from us, the way that we are given these laws that aren't actually common to us, the way that we can see the divisions between ourselves and our political leaders, and not just politicians, but individuals in the State Department working for various government agencies. And to me, it becomes very clear that it's actually a very stratified system where those in the lowest parts are actually fundamentally stripped of any and all kinds of rights. You know, a great example is children. You know, there's a number of rights that they're not entitled to into the society, in addition to other people like prisoners and to me, the scariest one is those that are labeled as enemy combatants, because it's very unclear how somebody becomes labeled an enemy combatant. And once they get that label, it becomes clear that they're actually stripped of rights. And to me, like, that's what the state of exception is where it starts to create these situations that it calls an emergency in order to gather more power for itself by precluding others, you know? And so Nazi Germany is a great example. Same thing here in the United States, the way that we strip Japanese people of their property without giving them any sort of judicial oversight. But I mean, like, this has been the tale for a long time. Pretty much every genocide that we see comes from the state making a label that these other people are the enemy in some way, and they're not entitled to the same rights as everybody else.
Sure. Yeah. So then what would be like a fellowship of oath versus an oath to the king?
Yeah. So there's this idea that was actually used to formulate the first communes in Europe during the 12th century or so. Maybe it was the 11th century. But essentially the idea was that the nobles were out there kicking the shit out of everybody and doing whatever they wanted. And it sucked a lot. So people were like, hey, this totally sucks. I would like for this not to happen to me. How about we get together, we make our own town, and we take an oath to one another? And so this was called Einshofgrofen, and it was a fellowship oath. And it was the idea that I would swear allegiance to you and the collective, and that you would swear allegiance to me and the collective together. And through that, we could create our own new territory and law. And from this evolved actually the guilds that would eventually create, a lot of the smaller powerful republics that we saw, including kind of the Venetian republics and others that were then able to kind of push along and advance technology in this way that, really is part of the greater story of the evolution of money itself vis-a-vis finance and other things.
Sure. Yeah. And what I also gathered from your work was that a commonwealth is, also about our health and our well-being.
And I think that's maybe the most important thing that isn't necessarily highlighted in our current commonwealth is that, so much of our society has evolved to this base idea of that if we can gather more money, that's somehow going to make us better. And everything else kind of has become secondary to it. And when you look at, ancient Greek republics such as the Spartans, like part of what created their system of power was making sure that there were a very robust and strong people that were concerned with everything else except for money. Money was actually like banished from their society, which they had a number of workarounds for. But I think that if we start trying to think about this as a societal health thing, is it healthy as a society that we are printing money seemingly ad infinitum, that there's no dialogue at all about how any money will get repaid in conjunction with people just seem to care about number go up, not necessarily just in Bitcoin, but in the stock market and their housing values and whatever it may be. And this has let everything else fall to the wayside and be neglected. It's very troubling because, we're essentially watching the crumbling of our republic under the weight of these things.
Yeah. You kind of touched on this a bit, but it's like, Can we look to the United States government and or the modern nation state to protect our health, well-being, and our wealth?
Clearly not. Like the simple fact that taxation is at such an extreme place today, and I understand it a desire to have the state redistribute that for the greater good of people, but the war machine is at an absolute all-time most powerful. We're developing more and more sophisticated weapons. And the fact that nuclear weapons even exist at this point in time, in my opinion, is utter insanity. That winning somehow is wiping out a large portion of the human race and dealing with the fallout of that, like, that's just craziness. And the fact that people act like having that power is somehow valuable to people, I mean, perhaps if we're using it to generate energy for good causes, but the idea of these sort of weapons, I just think is ludicrous and insane. And that's just one small example, is that when we look to the state to try to protect our wealth, it's very clear that they're interested in acquiring that for themselves first, and only so far as we're going to obey all their rules. If the state has any inkling that I made my wealth in a way that they don't like, they can just seize it. And that's problematic.
Yeah, that's very scary. In your writing, you also mentioned that Bitcoin is the most public thing. And I think you outline that in terms of like, will we put our wealth into Bitcoin and start collaborating with each other to form this commonwealth of the internet and through cryptography to protect our wealth beyond the state or any other? Is there a new political structure with Bitcoin?
Absolutely. And we're already seeing the affect of that with, essentially we've developed our own plebeian front lines that are out there like fighting this kind of infinite war against the fiat machine. And it's very clear that through the wealth that we've all been able to acquire and secure, the state can't really do anything about that. Like, sure, they can destroy our bodies, but like, that doesn't mean that they can still get our Bitcoin. And that makes it all the more powerful. And so I think as this continues to grow more and more, we're eventually going to see a pretty powerful movement that, in my opinion, will be quite dualistic. Because on one side, we'll actually have people utilizing the fiat wealth of their Bitcoin to fundamentally change industries. But I also think because these people are stepping into their own power, we're going to see them approaching the traditional political system, not to overthrow it and kind of take over it, but I really think doing as much as they can to disassemble it. And I'm very intrigued to see where that goes, because I would love to see the United States dissolve in a Soviet style where individual states assert their own sovereignty. But, you know, my guess is as good as any. I honestly don't know how we solve this dollar problem without it becoming a cataclysmic crisis.
Right. Do you think in that terms or any other, there's a potential for a constitutional amendment to abolish private money, aka the Federal Reserve?
You know, I do. I actually, even prior to, you know, what really set me off, and you had mentioned this earlier, in my youth before Bitcoin was, you know, like I had this bipolar episode where I ran for Senate. And part of the whole idea where I got from that was there is a clause in the Constitution called Article 5 that essentially you can pass amendments to the U.S. Constitution using state legislations only. And if you can get 35 state legislations to pass through their state legislatures bills to amend the U.S. Constitution, that's supposed to just get unilaterally ratified to the Constitution with no oversight from Congress or from the president. Now, this has never actually happened. So like, it's still all theoretical if it would actually play out. And I'm pretty sure that the Supreme Court would never let it happen. But I do think that a tactical approach like that would be very powerful, because, you know, while everybody deplores shitcoinery, the fact is if an individual state wanted to issue their own state currency vis-a-vis, you know, this sort of coin creation mechanism, I think that would be really interesting. I don't know if it would be good. And I think that it would be very intelligent for them to create a peg between their currency and Bitcoin. However, I do think that it is a tactic that individual states could use to try to free them from federal imperialism.
Yeah. Interesting. I want to turn to your idea that Bitcoin is the base layer for a new commonwealth. And to just kind of level set there, like, what is crypto? And I'm not talking about the crypto ecosystem. I'm talking about a cryptographic blockchain or time chain. And why was cryptography developed?
Yeah, I mean, so cryptography is an explicit tactic of war, first and foremost. I mean, even the Spartans, they had a rudimentary form of cryptography where they had a stick called a skytal, which, you know, was whatever length, but they would wrap a piece of leather around it. And so if all of the letters on that piece of leather they would wrap around it aligned, that would then decrypt whatever the message was. And so this was actually a tactic that gave them a strong benefit in war. Same thing with Caesar's cipher that he was able to utilize 500 years later in his war. And that was just a very basic cryptographic algorithm where he shifted the letters 3 to the left to write all of his letters. But so we've always seen this as a tactic of war that's been developed. And so, you know, in the Bitcoin ecosystem, people can get pretty aggressive towards the word crypto. But I think it's pretty funny because in Latin, it actually means secret. And it's important because this tactic of being able to keep a secret is an extremely powerful one. And particularly when we start using public key cryptography, we can now communicate in a way where we can prove to one another that this communication's secret. And so now that we bake this into Bitcoin, which it is arguably the largest monetary network on the planet with access to the most people, with the easiest and the most basic accessibility, well, this is fundamentally a social contract that we're all playing out together. You know, the nodes aren't just out there running themselves randomly, autonomously. Like, they're actual people that are behind all of this. And so even though this is all obfuscated up front with the actual cryptography and not knowing who or what we're dealing with, it's still created through a commonwealth that is a collective where we all have agreed to this system of Bitcoin and what its rules are. if you want, you know, 38 gajillion coins, there is a coin out there for you. Go and make that social contract. The Bitcoin social contract is one where there'll only ever be 21 million units. And most people seem to have aligned at this shilling point because of what it means and how that allows for nobody to fuck with the money.
Right. Unfuckable with. You know, you mentioned that war, you know, like sort of crypto is like a, has a secret nature, and even war is a secret nature. And one thing I've heard you say that really struck a chord with me is no one ever announces that there's a civil war going on. And part of that is sort of like the conflict between the federal government sometimes and even the state government, maybe not just people, but like who gets to make the law, who creates the exception. And so I'm wondering, is the United States government currently secretly at war with its own people?
Well, I mean, I don't think they'd ever tell us that, but it's pretty clear from my own personal experiences and from what's going on, you know, like Edward Snowden's a hero. He told us about horrific crimes that the federal government was carrying out against us, and they're treating him like he's the criminal and they're acting like they're innocent. You know, again and again, we're seeing these grotesque violations of our rights. And the federal government pretty much shrugs at it, you know? Like, I find it deplorable that so often our government excuses themselves from their crimes as opposed to taking responsibility. And to me, these are the signatures of a government that is actively at war with us. They're not telling us that, but they're clearly spying on us. They're clearly regarding us as enemies of the state by the way that they choose to treat us. And furthermore, the way that our rights get trampled on again and again in various situations, you know, I find really intimidating and scary. And so while I think that the word civil war might be a little extreme to describe it, it's clearly very clear to me that the amount of freedom that we can exercise is shrinking at a dramatic rate. And until I see that stop, you know, that's how I personally regard it, is that, yeah, we are at a war. Specifically, our federal government has imposed various levels of imperialism upon all of us, you know, and I actually, as an American, I would really love to see states stand up and fight back in a much more aggressive way, and not in this bullshit way that we see a lot of states do to dissolve responsibility from themselves, but real active resistance towards the federal government and the way that it wants to overstep its bounds.
Yeah. And I think during this this period of conflict and maybe aggression, you know, there are certain things in place. And I'm not going to get into speculation, you know, but there is, you know, KYC, AML surveillance. There is the potential for an Executive 6102 order with Bitcoin. Maybe they seize Bitcoin from exchanges on down. Something that you said very interesting about the real executive order 6102 was you can't steal and give back the same amount. It's just not how it works. I thought that was a very interesting point. And it makes me wonder, you know, are we subjects underneath a regime, whether we have rights guaranteed by the Constitution anymore? But one of my next question is really, you know, is the internet a new topology on the front of war?
Absolutely. You know, my piece that I wrote about the crypto partisan is this idea that look, like hackers are, or, you know, individuals that can utilize these security exploits are already some of the most powerful people on the planet, the way that they can shut down nuclear power plants, oil refineries, take out the power grid. And yeah, it's part of this totally new topology. And what I think is even more important from those like direct warlike tactics is more of that, like the propaganda has spilled out. And that's one of the things that I think Bitcoiners are absolutely crushing it on, is that this new form of like mnemonic warfare, where we're like fighting all of their propaganda by taking all of their things and folding it in on itself and memifying it, is extremely powerful, because we're communicating truths to them that they know and feel, but they could never necessarily pinpoint. And that we, and that, you know, Bitcoiners are delivering these really powerful messages critiquing it. And I think that that's really important, because part of the message that I want people to know is that, like, yeah, there is a war against you, and it's a war to make you a cog in the machine and to extract as much as you can, you know, with us being on the Bitcoin Matrix podcast. Like, yeah, it's like seeing the Matrix and realizing, like, oh shit, like I'm a battery that they drain all my juice from. They want me to be plugged into their thing 24/7 and take all of my life force from me. And I think once you start to recognize that, you can say, or I can choose to put my wealth in this esoteric, interesting, and different form that we haven't seen before, but it has true guarantees that I can cryptographically check myself. And I know that the rate of issuance isn't going to change, that tomorrow when I check the Bitcoin network, there is not going to be a single more Bitcoin than I expect. And that's a very radical idea that we haven't had access to for a very long time, at least since the banishment of gold as a storage of value. And so I think as the world comes to recognize what it means to have a hard money again and to choose to utilize that hard money, we're going to see some extremely powerful changes happen, because for so long, we've all had this wealth leached out of us to go feed. And I mean, think about the fact that the United States has more than 200 active military bases across the globe. Like, think of how much money that is spending.
Wow, right.
And that's all being extracted from us. You know, what if all of that money we all got to have again? You know, and even more importantly, what sort of things, what sort of investments could we individually choose?
Yeah.
If we had access to that money.
Just thinking about the reallocation of the money that, if we call it willingly pay in with taxes, you know, and if it was a fair contract. I mean, first of all, if taxes were really great and fair, we would all celebrate tax day and we would be like, I'm mailing in my money and we're going to all put it together and we're going to do great stuff. And so I think the fact that we're not excited to share in the Commonwealth via that mechanism says a lot. I wonder a lot about, you know, if we are in a war and the internet is such an important front in that war, how vulnerable is that front for us? Because I think the internet's not really very anti-fragile from maybe the user endpoint. And I don't think we have a lot of control over that. I wonder about how we can maintain our privacy in the digital age, whether by choice or not. And I wonder if anyone ever could like disappear again in the way that Satoshi did.
These are all really excellent questions. An essay that I've been working on for a long time, it's dealing with Heidegger's The Question Concerning Technology. And I bring it up because I think we're at this really, really interesting and extremely dangerous place, where the idea of being able to vanish in the way that Satoshi did, I think it could be possible, but like you would have to be really primo on your game with your OPSEC and how you're doing. And I think Satoshi was as well. You know, the fact that he mailed physical cash to register the Bitcoin org domain, you know, like that goes to show how much he was forward thinking about it. Now, with that being said, you know, like the deployment of Bitcoin as this backbone that can kind of rebuild everything into the cipher net, if you will. Is a very real possibility. And I think it's almost inevitable at this point, because it's very clear the actual risks that come up with allowing all of these centralized servers to hold all of our data, with us all being whitelisted in various ways. But with that being said, you know, like the Panopticon is very powerful right now. And if we had a Chinese style surveillance deployed everywhere right now, we would definitely be on the ropes. And the reason why I bring up Heidegger's Question Concerning Technology is he talks about, like, this is the fundamental essence of like what technology is that it has this idea for us that we can transform everything in the world into this standing reserve that's like readily at hand and available for people. But within this, there's this extreme danger that like he calls like the danger capitalized that can like fundamentally destroy all of humanity. But it's also in this exact same power that is the actual, what he also refers to as the saving power, which is this capacity to actually enter into a free relationship with technology that increases our individual power. And I think that this all captures perfectly what Bitcoin is and how it's functioning in the world today. And so that's one of kind of the most important open questions right now is, are we actually going to use the internet to become this extremely powerful liberative body to become the next political order of the world? Or is this going to be the final apparatus that captures humanity into a cage from which we'll never escape?
Right. Yeah, you pose fantastic questions. You know, at this point, I'm of the thought that when we hear a lot about another country, like doing surveillance at home, in their home, I start to think that like that's really happening more here than they want us to think, and that that's a red herring. I really do think that we have serious financial surveillance and social media surveillance here. And I almost think it might be even, well, I've never really done the study or done my own research, but I wonder maybe it is better than what's happening in China, because it is a little bit more decentralized in the sense that you have different entities focusing on their skill set and their niche. And I also, you know, I think there's, the more centralized you are, the more you're going to topple. So I wonder what their capabilities really are, even though I'm sure they have some strong capabilities on doing things that are very nefarious. I also, you know, I mean, we used to hear a lot about the Russian oligarchs and how they control and own the economy in Russia. And I wonder how much of that is just them trying to not let us think about how the oligarchs control the economy here, because I think we're in that situation. So kind of on that note, though, like what is crypto sovereignty as maybe described in the Declaration of Independence of Cyberspace more than 20 years ago?
Yeah, that if you've never had an opportunity to read the Declaration of Independence of Cyberspace, it's a fantastic document that was wrote by John Perry Barlow, one of the founders of the Electronic Freedom Foundation. And in it, he pretty much makes a declaration of, look, like we developed this space independent of all y'all, and it belongs to us, period. You're not welcome here. We don't want your laws here. And the great thing is your violence won't even work here. And to me, that was very similar to the American Declaration of Independence reserving this right for us to be able to create our own new commonwealth. And in my opinion, Bitcoin is exactly that, because it allows for us sovereignty through cryptography. My wealth is mine unilaterally, you know, and even though there's guys out there with $50 million in their bank and trading account or whatever else, in my opinion, that's not really theirs, because you know what? The state can say, I think you're a Muslim terrorist. I'm going to take all your property. I'm going to take all your banking stuff. I'm going to throw you in a prison cell and not give you habeas corpus or let you see a judge. And maybe I'm going to pour a bunch of water on your face upside down. I don't know. All I know is that you're not actually going to get any kind of access to the legal system, because I have created a specific label for you that classifies you under an emergency law to be able to take that away. Whereas, you know, with a multi-sig setup, having your Bitcoin in there, even if you're going to beat the crap out of me with your $5 wrench, I swear to God, I don't have that other key. So you're going to kill me, but you're not going to get the money that's there. And that's like a really powerful feature, because like throughout all of human history, people have always been able to show up with some baseball bats and beat out whatever they needed to. And, you know, at least in some times where people could have a cache of gold or something, they still kind of had that same capacity of refusal, but the physical nature of it always made it extractable, you know. And we're really on the precipice of being able to create some really cool new stuff, specifically with Taproot coming out. And I think like that's going to be some of the developments that are really going to create these powerful new political structures that, you know, essentially are going to have total and full sovereignty. And so I think kind of crypto sovereignty is understanding first and foremost that by utilizing cryptography as a personal power to protect your own wealth and privacy, that creates a totally new conception of sovereignty that we've never had in the world before.
Yeah. One thing that really fascinates me about your work is sort of this push and pull between truth versus authority that you explore. And you have this, I think it's in The Sovereign, the Subject, and Crypto Power, Political Life, the Digital Panopticon of the Modern Age. And you pull the Latin quote, I'll probably butcher this, veritas non auctoritas facit legum, truth not authority makes legitimacy. And how does that fit into with this new technology of cryptography and the blockchain or time chain, I should say?
Yeah. And so that specifically is an inversion of a quote from Thomas Hobbes, where pretty much at the end of Leviathan, he surmises that the sovereign's power essentially is authority, not truth creates legitimacy. Auctoritas not veritas fact legitimum. And so the inversion of that is truth, not authority, creates legitimacy. That's the current world we're going into. the law and its authority no longer has force within, you know, the topology of the internet. However, Bitcoin does. And that radically augments and changes the functions of how we understand legitimacy in the world today. And I think that that's, you know, more or less one of the crises that we're seeing right now is that, and I actually think kind of the apex of it was at the start of this whole coronavirus fair, when we had the CDC director telling us that masks don't help, you know, and like, we all knew on its face that that was bullshit, because they were like, well, if you're a doctor, it's different. And like the fact that they had the brazenness to assert their authority in such a way against what clearly wasn't true kind of goes to show that, in addition to the fact of the way that we saw the entire ironically like immune response of the internet pop up with all of this questioning and ideas and differences, and including being the first ones to kind of flag alarm that there was something weird going on in China, I think is pretty interesting overall. And I think it's really important to see that throughout all of human history, the knowledge that was given to us was filtered through all of these various means. And, you know, the Gutenberg printing press was really the first iteration of people being able to get their hands on the, you know, books that could fill them with their own knowledge and radically change their view of the world. And we're having that same affect with the internet again. I mean, like the fact that all of us were able to go out on the internet, learn about peer-to-peer cryptography, how Bitcoin functions, what digital signatures are, you know, all of this, and educate ourselves is an extremely powerful thing. You know, even if somehow Bitcoin was magically destroyed tomorrow, it would pop back up immediately. And that's because people understand the power that cryptography offers them into building these new systems that fundamentally, from first principles, can't get fucked with.
Yeah, I mean, I'm fascinated by all the stuff you're unpacking here. What is the equality of the Bitcoin protocol, and how do the private keys bind us all together, or our private keys bind us all together?
Yeah, like, you know, the Bitcoin network doesn't know who I am and it doesn't know who you are. It homogenizes all of us through our private keys. It just knows someone owns some private key somewhere and that private key is theirs. And through that homogeneity, it means that there's true equality under the protocol of Bitcoin. Now, we could say that tainting services like Chainalysis and others that are tracking real-world identities and tying that together, possibly that influences and destroys some of the homogeneity, but because of the way that we can constantly renew identities, transfer coins to new addresses, and to be able to rely on the actual pseudo-anonymous protocols that are baked directly into Bitcoin, it allows for us this totally different network of equality, if you will, that anytime that I go to claim my Bitcoin, so long as I have exposed my private key and at this point in time paid a sizable fee to the mempool, it'll actually get processed. You know, whereas in our contemporary legal system, if I cross the wrong person, again, I can be deprived of what is legally my own private property. You know, I think one of the most atrocious crimes that happens in the United States today is asset seizure. And the fact that like asset seizure in terms of its amount outdoes the actual criminal amount that's stolen is ludicrous. You know, like that's one of those facts about the current day and age that, you know, I would go to show shows the corruption of the law. The fact that a cop can steal stuff from you and call that legal is outright wrong. And the great thing is that that can't happen with your Bitcoin if it's been secured correctly.
You know, you've written that crypto is a religion insofar that statism is also a religion. And I couple that with, is Bitcoin divine?
Oh, you know, I like to think it is. You know, and this is kind of where some of my more extreme thoughts come out. Like the fact that Satoshi Nakamoto came up at this point in time and gave us this beautiful invention that's working 10 years later as expected is incredible, you know, not just because of the actual access it does, but it renews this new hope in humanity that I think a lot of us Bitcoiners see. And it's one that we're not ultimately doomed to have the state run all of our political affairs into the future. You know, that there's this actual possibility of something radically different from what any of us could have expected before. And I think it's really important because those of us that really believe in Bitcoin and have chose to make it our, you know, our storage of wealth and where we choose to keep the vast majority of our wealth is really important because, you know, the ideas that we're pushing forward here have the same legitimacy as that of the state, and even more so because of the way that it contains truth and not authority, whereas the state with its authoritarian ideals of who and what should own what, who and what is legal, like that's a religious idea. The fact that individuals that are selling pharmaceuticals to people that are dying in massive droves, while individuals that sell weed on the dark market go to jail, it just goes to show some kind of the insincerities of it. And furthermore, the way that we have district attorneys, you know, kind of other individuals of the state defending these things, saying that that's okay, goes to show that it's a religion. Because if it wasn't religious, we could actually have a real ethical conversation about what was going on. And is this appropriate for one person to go to jail for providing a mind-altering substance, whereas another individual gets to get rich even though their substance is killing people?
Yeah, I mean, so I think you mentioned that governments are not gods. You know, you brought up these kind of like what should be the slogans are like war is peace, freedom is slavery, ignorance is strength. And then you kind of allude to like blinding the sovereign. So like, what are we getting at with blinding the sovereign?
Yeah, through cryptography, like the panopticon can't function anymore. All these surveillance things start to break down. And it's really important because by having cryptography act as this fundamental base by which we start creating new social contracts through the internet, the state's just precluded from the interaction and it can't monitor or participate in it anymore. And that becomes this really interesting and powerful tool because, again, going back to the idea of truth, not authority being the core functionality of it, we can start to kind of question everything and know that we're always going to come back to truth at our base. Whereas in the contemporary system, everything is found in this huge labyrinth or catacombs of laws that are supposed to direct our thoughts and ideas and morals and ethics, you know, as opposed to truth itself.
Yeah. I mean, we kind of talked a lot about how, you know, we're in this perpetual state of emergency and so we it's like Bitcoin and the emergency. And we see the emergency, the exceptions with Snowden, Assange, and Ross Ulbricht, Free Ross, you know, and I don't think we need to get into their cases too much. But like, what are you, you know, afraid of now? And not that you're afraid of anything as, you know, a single man, a person, and that you have fear other men, but like, what are your concerns about what you see going on now? And where do you think things are going? And when I say the next 1 to 3 years here, I'm not talking about so much Bitcoin and Bitcoin the price, but like more about like where do you see the state going and things playing out between what the fuck happened in 2020 and how we're going to play out over the next couple of years?
Well, everything's open. The thing that I'm the most afraid of is essentially like we're cattle as people at this point in time. You know, like all of the wildness and resistance has really been bred out of us, and the way that we've been taught to comply. You know, like to me, that's what a large part of the coronavirus hysteria has been about, is making sure that this authoritarian compliance is carried out no matter what. And I find it's really scary, you know, and not so much because, you know, I think whatever your opinion is of the virus anyway about it, I don't, the fact that all of this kind of surveillance wasn't conducted in times before, the fact that the government is now radically printing out money, and there's not even a question of where that money is coming from or how it will get repaid. You know, the fact that these huge technological powers are amassing huge fortunes and doing it through compliance with the state and essentially feeding them the information feeds that they want, you know, I all find deeply alarming. And my greatest fear is essentially that the panopticon, which this is a word that Michel Foucault got from another philosopher, Jerry Bethlehem, of the 18th century. And panopticon is this idea of a prison that a central guard tower in the middle can monitor all prisoners at all points in time. And part of how the Panopticon creates its power is through the idea of that you never know if somebody's actually watching you. They could be watching you, but you're just not sure. And this puts us into a very 1984 style world where I become afraid that because people become so compliant and so afraid that they are being watched, that for each time our rights are violated in a new and different way, there's never any sort of resistance. And it's pretty clear to me that that's kind of the direction we're going.
Yeah. My final question for you is, as you touched a little bit about Marxism in the beginning, I was kind of thrown for a loop. I'm not sure what your theory of thoughts were there, but I'm really interested. So what kind of like were you alluding to?
Curious. Marxism, you know, and to keep Marxism itself separated from communism, Marxism has a very interesting way that it understands capital and its relationship to labor. While I can't delve into details, A, because I'm just not that schooled in Marx, and two is because I butcher it quite a bit, is I actually think Marx's labor theory of value aligns with Bitcoin pretty well through the energy consumption that it has. And through doing an analysis of essentially Marxian economics, accounting for the energy that Bitcoin's outputting, I think that there's something pretty interesting there. In addition to the fact that I think those on the far left, if they could understand that Bitcoin is an implementation of anarchist ideology first and foremost, I think it might try to afford them over to our side of the aisle a bit, you know? And I think one of the important things to also point out is that like anarchists and communists are pretty much in the same camp, with the exception of that, as most people understand communism today, they want to hijack the state to force their ideas onto everybody. Whereas anarchists want to destroy the state first and foremost. And they think once the state's destroyed, from that, a whole new collective of ideas will blossom. And it's that, and like that's literally why anarchists left the First International Alliance that Marx had put together, was because Marx was like, so let's take over the state and beat the crap out of everybody. And anarchists were like, whoa, like we don't want anything to do with the state. Like, this is a terrible idea. We're like out of here. And that's kind of where the schism happened. So yeah, essentially, I would appreciate if instead of Marxists finding themselves on the explicit left-right divide that I don't think really exists, if they could really take the idea of what Bitcoin is more seriously as a non-state monetary tool, I think it would be pretty helpful to them.
Yeah, very interesting. I'm going to go a little Bitcoin audible on you. Shout out Guy Swan. I'm going to read a bit back to you. So linguistic and metaphysical so far beyond the economic breakthrough because of the truth contained in this time chain. We're talking about Bitcoin here. Through using cryptography to create a novel and fair economic game of wealth common to all, Bitcoin rediscovered the sovereign power that is hidden at the center of what a commonwealth really is. The commonality of wealth to all, with no one able to control or change the system for the betterment of some at the cost of others. In other words, it is commonality of law itself, the capacity and demand for law to remain totally neutral and completely access to everyone, no matter their station of birth, creed of faith, or political identity according to the state. With this radical new power of peace, man finds himself back at the start of all political concepts once again. However, this time man emerges from the forest of technology, armed with the final weapon of cryptography and the mask of anonymity, of which hides the face of the messianic possibility it contains. Man has renewed the opportunity to liberate himself from the concentration camps of modernity, but this time for good, permanently and forever. Quoted by Eric Kaysen. This has been so dope, Eric. I can't tell you how much I've enjoyed this. I've looked forward to this a long time. I know we had some hems and haws pulling it together way back since December. So I really appreciate you taking the time out and coming on the show. I'll leave it to you for any parting words, and definitely let people know where they could find you.
Cool. Yeah, my name's Eric Kaysen. You can find my writings at cryptosovereignty.org. I really appreciate you having me on, Sed, and I really appreciate that you dug into some of my work and asked some really great and poignant questions. Yeah, and that last quote there really highlights a lot of my feelings, and that we're really lucky to be here, to be participating in this, and to witness you know, what I think historically is going to be recognized as this transition of power from state-based political systems to cryptographically based political systems. And we're just at the dawn of it. And it's very, very exciting. If you liked some of the fun stuff we talked about, go check out some of my essays. I'd appreciate it.
Yeah, man. We're at the beginning of so many different facets of Bitcoin. Bitcoin is more than just money. It's more than just gains. It really opens up a new paradigm. And, you know, I really don't think paradigms ever really get opened up too much in humanity. There's nothing new under the sun except for Bitcoin. So absolutely. I really appreciate, man. This has been so dope. Thank you
it
so
has
much.
Been super dope. Yeah. Really, really appreciate your time, man.
Eric Kaysen on the transfer of power from state-based political systems to cryptographically based political systems, and truth versus authority and the law, right here on the Bitcoin Matrix podcast. And thank you for listening. If you dig the chats, please subscribe, drop a 5-star review, and share a link to the pod with your best friends and family. That's the best way to spread the word, so I can keep grinding out thought-provoking conversations about Bitcoin. Keep learning and keep stacking. This is Sed. Peace out.